Today I wanted to talk about religion and politics in the United States. And I should say that, to begin with here, that this has not been a much studied topic, even though you may think you've heard a lot about it in the last couple of years. I think that's principally been caused by the phenomenon that's often referred to as the rise of the new Christian right, Pat Robertson's attempt to get the Republican nomination for president, Jerry Falwell and the Moral Majority's involvement in politics. But one of the big framework ideas here is that this is not, at least in our lifetime, yours and mine, this is not something that's been a very constant factor. And so one of the jobs is always to explain why, after decades of relative unimportance for religion, why now this is a big, at least it seems to be a big topic. One of the reasons I might just cite here at the beginning is that we pride ourselves on being a liberal democracy, liberal with a small L here, liberal meaning that we inherit the ideas from the Anglo-American political tradition, the tradition of Thomas Hobbes and John Locke, running then through Jefferson and Madison, two of the more intellectual and important of the founding fathers. And the root to liberal is the Latin word libera, which means free. And so liberalism in that sense doesn't mean, you know, Ted Kennedy, if that's, you know, or whoever you put out on the more on the left in American politics. Liberalism really means of a political philosophy, an approach to politics that emphasizes freedom, free choice. And we try our best to maintain our position as a kind of leader among liberal democracies. So that kind of emphasis, which got a real big push in that period, especially in European history known as the Enlightenment, that approach, among other things, sees religion as something that limits choice. This is an idea that comes mainly out of France and continental Europe, but religion is, in terms of liberal democracy, seen as a bad influence. And there was some practice that kind of backed up this idea in Europe. And this, of course, many of the early settlers to the United States came from places like England and Holland and Germany, where the tradition was a very kind of repressive tradition, where the church backed up the authority of the state. So in our Constitution and in the Declaration of Independence, you have statements that I think probably are at least meant to be neutral with regard to religion, although there is in the Declaration of Independence, you know, reference to Creator. Still, I think that the weight of those early documents is that religion and democracy are probably, in many senses, antithetical kinds of concepts. Well, that idea has been what is largely behind the stand of the Constitution on the First Amendment, and even more important, the stand of the courts, especially the Supreme Court of the United States, and as it has interpreted the First Amendment. Back at Valparaiso University, where I come from, by the way, I'm Al Trost, I probably should have said that since we always have people coming in and out of here. I've been a professor of political science at Valparaiso University at least for two-thirds of my career. Now I'm in administration. But at Valparaiso, we've had a series of lectures this year by various people coming in who have meant to tell us that this idea that religion is antithetical to liberal democracy needs to be investigated a bit more and may not be, in fact, the right approach. One of the people who has been by is Ron Thieman, who is a divinity school dean, Lutheran, who has come and said that, we should move against this idea, not that religion takes over the country as the European cases we discussed yesterday, but that we need to, as religious people, have more of a voice in the running of our government. Well, that's the kind of general conflict that is there, and this is such a strong idea that in the professional association that political scientists belong to, called the American Political Science Association, you could not get a paper in religion and politics published until the late 70s. And those of us who were researching in the area had to start something called the Caucus for Religion and Politics in order to get our work looked at. And it wasn't necessarily evangelical work. I mean, we weren't trying to redeem the American Political Science Association, but it was seen as a kind of regressive move, you know, to go back and look at religion when the kind of overwhelming opinion was that, you know, if the more of a liberal democracy you become, the less religious of influences there are. And so it's kind of in that sense an uphill struggle. Now, I'm happy to say that this caucus is now at a recognized subsection of the American Political Science Association, and when there are annual conventions, those of us studying the areas are given a part of the official program, and then we meet in a kind of rump session as well to strategize on joint projects. And there are two big ones I might mention going on. Much of the activity here is by Jewish political scientists who are trying to kind of reclaim an ethical center to American politics, but there are a lot of Lutherans involved in this, and a lot of people from the Reformed tradition who are also looking at this question right now. Well, that's one big framework idea. Another one I've mentioned before when I was going over the European situations yesterday, and that is the idea again of secularization. Those of you who were here, I described it as a kind of glacier that inches forward, secularizing the culture and the society, or so it seems. First of all, I should say that the United States stands out as a culture in which religion is still about as important as it is any place in the Christian world, any place like Canada, Australia, Europe, and what is secularized most is the state or the government. The culture is still pretty much, I think, shows evidence of religious influences. But there's not much question that the state, and this is what Jefferson and Madison and some of the other Federalists were concerned about, there's not much question that today it is a pretty secular institution. I'd like to talk first a little bit about the idea of separation of church and state, which is, again, the kind of idea that pushes forward the idea that we shouldn't have religious influences. And then I'd like to look at for a brief moment at the judicial interpretation of the First Amendment to the Constitution. There are two parts of the Constitution where religion is mentioned. One is in the original Constitution, where religious tests for offices are prohibited. This was a big thing for the Founding Fathers. They didn't want to have people asked. The thing they were most afraid of is that people would be asked if they were a member in good standing of the Church of England. And many of the Founding Fathers would have had to answer that question no. So they were interested in not having a religious test for public office. But then that has hardly been interpreted in the courts at all. That's almost an irrelevant section of the Constitution. There are irrelevant sections of the American Constitution, and that's one of them. But the most important part, of course, is the First Amendment to the Constitution, which is part of what we call the Bill of Rights, the first 9 amendments. And we're only interested, of course, here in just a phrase or two of that. The Bill of Rights starts out, "Congress shall make no law respecting the establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof." And then it goes on to talk about free speech and free assembly. But the two parts there are, "Congress shall make no law respecting the establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof." And the way we've interpreted the Constitution is more or less to separate those two parts. I'm not sure the Founding Fathers meant that, but that's how it's come out. And so you have kind of two lines of interpretation. You have a very strenuous effort on part of the government, especially the courts here, to say that government should give no help to religious institutions or religious value system. The government should remain neutral there at the very least. And then you have the free exercise clause, as it's called, "Congress shall make no law respecting or prohibiting the free exercise of religion," where the courts have moved in what might even be an opposite direction, where most religious practices have been allowed to go ahead, and where the prevailing sentiment of the community may be against it, like, for instance, the annoying knock on the door from the Jehovah's Witnesses, or the solicitation by the Hare Krishna people in airports. The courts have said that, the main line of, it, of interpretation here has said that there should be no constraints on this unless there are some rules that are give us some exceptions here if public security or safety is endangered. For instance, the courts have been more ambiguous when it comes to the use of narcotics or drugs in religious ceremonies. There are questions, again, of public security and safety and influencing children that might come up. But in most cases, the court has been, and in some respects, more consistent in the free exercise part than it has been in the establishment part. Now, having said that, I also have to say that the courts said almost nothing about the First Amendment religious clauses until the Second World War. The Supreme Court was concerned with other parts of the Constitution, but it did not do very much at all with the religious part, the two religious clauses of the First Amendment until the Second World War. There were a few cases involving parochial schools in Oregon and Nebraska. There was a case involving polygamy among Mormons. But otherwise, practically nothing. In World War II, we begin to see the court active here in the area, again, of freedom, the challenging of the freedom of religious groups to speak out about things. And in the fervor of the war, the court tried to maintain, I think, more a kind of peaceful situation and was guided less by maybe legal reasoning. But this did mark the entry into public discourse now of some concerns about religion. The first cases involved flag salute. Again, Jehovah's Witnesses, members of the Jehovah's Witnesses religious group, refused to salute the flag because they see this as a violation of the commandment that we should have no other gods before the God, and the flag for them was a god. And initially the court ruled against the Jehovah's Witnesses. 2 years later, that decision was reversed or turned around, and that then marked the beginning of a kind of record here of upholding the idea of freedom of religion. One other kind of case came in there, and that students these days, if I ever bring in court cases, I never talk about these because it's completely foreign, but some of you are perhaps old enough here to remember this. In the 1950s, again, realizing that you couldn't teach religion in the public schools, a number of school systems went with something called release time. And if you remember that, where, you know, you could leave school, given permission to leave school, or in some cases, the churches came into the schools to give religious instruction. And so this was another kind of category of interpretation of the First Amendment that arose in, especially here in the 1950s, the so-called release time cases, where the court, now you begin to see how the court is less clear about what it means to have separation of church and state, or what it means to interpret these two parts of the First Amendment. And so at first, there was a kind of, no, you can't do this if it's in the schools itself, but then there was permission given to hold these classes outside of school. The concern of the court, the kind of consistency between these two cases seems to be, if you make the kids that don't want to go to release time feel bad, and use the resources of the school district itself, both its money and its sanctioning power, then it's unconstitutional. If somehow the students do it at the end of the day, where it's not obvious that some students are doing this and other students are doing that, and you don't use the punishment mechanism in the school system, truancy, let's say, to enforce this, then it's okay. And this begins then a kind of pattern, and this is probably one of my few references to the handout I gave you here. You'll see this is somebody's interpretation, not mine, but these are basically establishment cases. And you see that there are some that go in the direction of building the wall of separation, as Jefferson called it, higher, and some that are called accommodationists. This means that that government's role here is more to not do anything to hinder the flourishing of religion, to set up a system in which religion can be accommodated in the public sphere. So there is, over the long term, then this kind of inconsistency. Well, it's not inconsistency. The Supreme Court justices would hate to hear me say that. It's not inconsistency. The Supreme Court and all the courts underneath it rule with certain interpretive rules, and the one that's prevailing right now in these establishment cases is a threefold test, although even that's been qualified a bit, where when you have a practice, let's say putting a cross on the city hall, or reciting the Ten Commandments in a school, or saying a prayer in school, the court uses this test to see whether it's a violation of their understanding of no establishment or separation of church and state. And one of the things that's involved in this is whether in policing the religious practice that's going on, the state gets entangled too much with the religion. And another one, a part of this, of the test, is whether result, the impact of the decision, and if it upholds establishment, this has to be shown here by the people wanting to carry on with the religious practice, that it also furthers a secular purpose that can be affirmed by most of the people in the society. Let me give you one example of that. One of the early cases here, I think it's on here, Everson versus the Board of Education, 1947. Notice that accommodationist is the judgment there. This was a case of children who were being bused to parochial schools by public school buses, something that still goes on in my community. I don't know if it goes on in yours or not, but it still goes on in mine. And in this case, this was challenged by people who thought that this was furthering religion, leading to an establishment of religion. And in this case, the court said an overriding secular purpose, they weren't yet using that secular purpose language, that doesn't come till 1973, but kind of an overriding consideration here is the safety of the kids. You know, the school district has to get the kids to school without having an accident or being hit by a car or something. And so this practice of busing is going to be allowed, even though the court recognized it is helping the parochial schools. They don't have to dig into their own pockets to fund a school bus service. Still, this is something that is serving a general secular purpose. And as a matter of fact, almost all the cases involving help to parochial schools are based largely on this idea of secular purpose. And also another test that's used is whether the courts are truly neutral with regard to one religion, one denomination over another. And that's been broadened to say that the stance of the government has to be neutral, not only with regard to Catholic, Protestant, and Jew, and Muslim, but also with regard to people who choose to be atheists. Atheism now has standing as a religious tradition, and so the court has to be neutral with regard to all of those traditions. So the secular purpose test is one that's used in parochial schools. So again, I don't know if any of you teach in parochial schools or have the mic come out of the Missouri Synod, where we have our own parochial school system, and we have a very large one in Valparaiso, and a very large Lutheran school. And there are a number of things that go on there. We send our kids away to the public schools for music instruction. And school buses pick them up, which has been challenged several times at our local court. Okay to bring them to school in the morning, but how about this extra effort here? This has been challenged, and one of the cases is on appeal now through the Indiana court system. But the first instance court here, the court of first instance, ruled in favor of the school and the practice. But some kinds of diagnostic testing go on in parochial schools. This is again something, you know, that's beneficial, the court has ruled, to the general population. So, I think sometimes we perceive this as part of the general secularization, that the court is pushing ahead to secularize the society. I think that that is probably after the kind of initial judgment is made that religion probably is antithetical to liberal democracy if it has obvious influence in the state. After that, I don't think that there is a clear pattern of that one could say the courts are in back of further secularization of the political system. Certainly they're not accommodating either, but I think that it's been a record of in some kinds of cases pushing more in the religious direction, in other kinds of cases perhaps pushing the wall of separation maybe a little bit higher. One other thing I meant to say, and again, you probably saw this with Terry Fredheim earlier. You get, when you teach this all the time, you're flooded with all kinds of things that you could say here about how the courts work and all of that. But the idea of separation of church and state is not a constitutional. It's not in the Constitution. This is how Jefferson and Madison thought about it, and in fact the kind of text for this is a letter that Jefferson wrote to the Danbury, Connecticut Baptist Convention, in which he talks about a separation of church and state, because that was, again, his concept. You probably all heard before, the idea that some of the founding fathers, especially the ones most influenced by the Enlightenment, and Jefferson was of that stripe. In fact, he was in France for a while, read many continental authors, many French philosophers. They were, their religious persuasion was usually what's called deism, where there's a recognition of God or some kind of transcendent power that got the world started. That's why you have in the Declaration of Independence, the words endowed by their creator with certain inalienable rights. This is compatible with the deist notion. But when you're talking about denominational religion, at least with the people who were most influential in writing the Constitution, Declaration of Independence, the Bill of Rights, they were not what we would describe today as evangelical Christians. I know that that's something that's often very much distorted. When we go to patriotic ceremonies, people will cite the founding fathers and what they intended. I think what they intended is very simply stated in the Constitution. There should be no establishment of religion, and there should be free exercise of religion. That's what the founding fathers intended. The baggage that's come onto it has come on after the Constitution was written. Does anybody have any questions about that? Going into constitutional law in such a baby step like that is probably more dangerous than if I had to leave it alone. Yes, Paul?
Maybe you got into this yesterday, but the Anglican tradition in England, yes, of which we came, the established church, in the 18th century, it was very strongly Anglican.
Yes.
And it was not until the 19th century that Anglicanism began to lose its monopoly, and secularization forces began to eat away at its monopoly. And,
yes.
And others were given support by the state. It seems to me that our founding fathers would have come out of a tradition which defined establishment as a specific...
As an English idea.
That's right, yes. As a specific church body. And it's always confused me as to how establishment can be broadened to include just any religion at all. Am I on the right track?
Yes, no, well, it's certainly with regard to the founding fathers, their experience. I mean, if you even limit it to Jefferson and Madison, Virginia was an Anglican colony, and certainly their idea there. And by the way, the states had established religions, not all of them, but some of them had established religions until the beginning of the 19th century. I think New Hampshire was the last one to end establishment. So while the United States, the federal principle, was no establishment, there was establishment in not all of the colonies, not all of the original states, but in some of the states. And certainly the cultures were homogeneous then. I mean, you had Quakers in Pennsylvania, and you had Puritans in Massachusetts, and Baptists in Rhode Island, and Catholics in Maryland, and so there was more homogeneous cultures generally at that time. But it was, I didn't talk about Britain yesterday. Establishment there is... some of you know, means, first of all, that the queen, the monarch, is head of the church, defender of the faith, or the constitutional words in Britain. Members of the hierarchy of the Church of England sit in the House of Lords. 26 bishops and archbishops of the Church of England are in the House of Lords. Even the revisions of doctrine and liturgy in Britain have to be passed by Parliament, by the House of Commons, principally. House of Lords has become a very weak body. Plus, there are all kinds of protections given to the holdings of the church, the financial holdings of the church. So this was what Jefferson and Madison were reacting to. This was much more powerful, as Paul was saying, in the 18th century than the case now in Britain. Much more recognition of the power of the church. The church was, again, the priest to the rulers in England at this time. Well, that's one aspect of the secularization of the society, of the political system, and again, you know, it would be hard to claim that we've moved in a desecularizing direction, but I don't think that there has been as much movement there as many people think. That's my position. I know that there are certain symbolic areas, like prayer in the public schools, that tend to get a lot of attention. But since I've been kind of involved with the parochial school system, I see another side to this, where there has been some encouragement not only to the private sector in elementary and secondary education, but even to higher education. Now, that doesn't mean that the government is making gigantic steps to make it easy for private schools to exist, church-related schools to exist, but I don't think that there are strong moves otherwise either, that is in the contrary direction. Okay?
You see a problem with this coming moving around the country for school vouchers as, okay for the civic one, but not for the church-related one?
I think that, if that looks to the courts to be something that's going to help parochial school systems over against public school systems, I think that it's going to be declared certainly unconstitutional, as it has been in certain settings. It's been allowed to exist. Milwaukee, Wisconsin is an area or one part of the country.
Okay, school vouchers to church-related schools, but allow them for...
That's right. Yes. Yes. That's right. Yeah. And I understand, Paul. Maybe you know more about this. I understand that that is the Milwaukee, Wisconsin practice. Milwaukee has a voucher system, and people can carry the voucher into both. And that's the reason that it's so far stood tests in the court. But I think, again, if this looks to be in its legislative history, when the courts look at that as an attempt to save or support parochial schools, and I think it's what everything else the court has said is probably going to be ruled unconstitutional. Anything else on those cases? Let me then talk a little bit more about some of the other religious influences on the culture as it affects politics. There is one kind of model or conceptualization of this that I particularly like. It's by an English sociologist of religion, David Martin, who has written a book called A General Theory of Secularization. And he talks about stages where the first thing that is secularized is the state. The next thing that happens in secularization is that the state expands into areas that were previously the province of the church and other private associations, schools, hospitals, welfare services. The third step is that the secularization expands into the culture, into the value system. Now, I think a strong case can be made that we have a secular political system in terms of the separation of church and state. And I see a lot of movement towards secularization also in this next area, where the government expands into areas previously provided by church-related institutions. Hospitals would be one of these that I see, right? I mean, part of this is pushed forward by finances. Right now, we live in the Chicago area again. Valparaiso's in the Chicago area. And there's a big movement toward merger of hospital foundations and corporations now. So, what used to be Presbyterian St. Luke's is probably now going to become Northwestern Presbyterian St. Luke's, a bunch of other things, because, again, of financial considerations. But because of government aid to education, government aid for health, the federal government, again, has insisted upon a neutrality standard. And what this has done is to kind of remove a lot of the obvious religious elements from hospitals that were previously St. Margaret's, Lutheran General, Presbyterian Hospital, and so forth. And it has also, I think, had some influence in welfare agencies. I'm, again, somewhat familiar with Lutheran Family Services and Lutheran Refugee and Immigration Service. And the taking of government funds there has, again, pushed them in the direction of being neutral as they serve clients. So that, you know, if, for instance, in adoption in our area of the country, Catholic Relief Services or Catholic Social Services is the agency that does adoptions in Northwest Indiana. And, you know, if you're a Lutheran wanting to adopt a child, or if you're an atheist wanting to adopt a child, you go through Catholic Family Services. And the agency continues to be called Catholic Family Services, but, you know, the days when it was run by an order of nuns, and what they did was to go into the Catholic homes to watch the upbringing of children, that is gone. And so this is, again, I suppose one could see this as an area of expansion of a secular polity into an area previously owned by the church. Now schools, which you brought up before, are an area where we still have a church-related school system. And again, I mean, there sometimes when you think that, you know, maybe this is about to go, but it's not been, I don't think, a clear line of challenge. And one of the more encouraging things that I have seen here is that to the extent that the church is willing, to go back to your question about vouchers, to the extent that the church is willing to stay in the inner city, in urban locations, it seems that a government takes a more benevolent attitude in that kind of case, because they want quality alternatives to the public school system in the city center. And I've seen that in Chicago, where, again, the state of Illinois and the city of Chicago, which otherwise, you know, try to do their best often to appear neutral with regard to religion, have done some things in terms of grants, money, and in terms of attitude, which seem to encourage that school system. But I think, again, you know, with the metaphor of a glacier here, you know, there is erosion here, but there still is, and especially when you think of other countries in Europe, there still is a pretty strong religious influence, especially in through the parochial school systems. I want to talk a little bit about, now going more to the culture. In the 1970s, the beginning of the 1970s, when a lot of these court cases that seemed to be pointing in a separationist direction occurred, and when there seemed to be a movement also generally after the Kennedy and Johnson administrations, to government more vigorously and aggressively moving in where voluntary associations used to be, there was a kind of pessimism afoot that religion really was losing out. And a man by the name of Robert Bellah, some of you who may have heard of him before, came and identified a kind of idea of a religious aura. Not a religious institution, but a kind of aura, a mindset that was afoot in the country, which he called civil religion. And he thought that this was a good thing, because what it did, it's again non-doctrinal. I mean, as he defines it himself, it's the attempt to perceive a transcendent or supernatural force in the United States. So when a president like Lincoln will say something like, you know, history will judge us because of our activity, for instance, with slavery, putting history into, see, you're taking it out of humankind, you're making it seem like a transcendent, something above us, something mystical in a way, that this is and has to be recognized as a religious influence. Now again, you know, for kind of people who have been brought up in confessional theology, as Lutherans and Presbyterians and Christian Reformed people and Catholics have been, I mean, this seems pretty non-confessional kind of thing, and it's perhaps requires more effort on our part to see this as a religious influence. But Bella identified it, and in fact, thought that it was a wholesome influence because it integrated the country. It unified the country. After he wrote that article, about 5 years later, he himself got a little more pessimistic as he saw the decline of civil religion. Some of the things he identified, this is kind of an interesting thing, but again, it's another lecture, is the Lincoln Memorial, Jefferson Memorial, or Lincoln's tomb in Springfield. You know, that's a kind of a sacred place. It's not sacred, again, you know, if you're a confessional Christian, but it's a sacred place, and he talked about how everybody got quiet when they went in Lincoln's tomb, you know, kind of a recognition again of a supernatural presence or transcendence. He talked about some of the rituals in the United States. One of the great moves forward, one of the reasons Bella even wrote his initial article on civil religion was that this was just about the time when Under God was added to the Pledge of Allegiance. Again, our children have been brought up with Under God, but you know, when I went through Boy Scouts and that, it wasn't in the Pledge of Allegiance. So, you know, I mean, this gave a lot of encouragement to Bella. You know, well, there is something there. It's not, again, very doctrinal, but you know, there's a recognition of a transcendent presence. Well, 5 years later, he wrote another book in which he said, well, maybe this wasn't quite the strong force he thought, and then a very influential book about 10 years ago called Habits of the Heart, which had the kind of gloomy prediction that individualism and individualistic religion was winning out in the United States. And he has a couple of really kind of pithy quotes from interviews that he gave there, where one woman, I think, even identified her religion as Bellaism. No, not Bella, that's his name. What was her name? Suzanneism or something like that, you know, that the religion she followed was what was good for Suzanne. Well, not everybody feels like that, certainly, you know, it's a very tiny minority of the country, but he then didn't see civil religion. It's kind of interesting that there are all kinds of articles on civil religion in the 70s and maybe even the early 80s, but now you see almost nothing on this in the United States. If you're familiar with Japanese culture, they have, in fact, a kind of an official civil religion called Shintoism, so that you know, that you can perceive this or see this in other cultures. But I think that now not too many people make a case for this. But anyway, it's another place in which, you know, there is a kind of religious influence in politics. Let me say a little bit then about religion in the presidency and religion and elections, and I'll try to do that in about 4 minutes, at least 10 minutes at least for comments and questions. One of the ways in which other people have seen a religious influence in politics that has persisted almost up to the present is in the kind of moral indignation that people feel when they're betrayed by their leaders. You know, this is a fellow by the name of Meade, Robert Meade, wrote a book called The Nation with the Soul of a Church. And he was talking about America. This is about the time, again, of the civil religion stuff. And he, actually, I'm not sure he was promoting so much moralism in American politics, but he was, in fact, commending it for attention. And one sees this most, I think, in the Nixon condemnation and resignation from office. You know, people were really kind of horrified that Nixon would lie and, you know, promote the Watergate, that kind of thing. My wife and I happened to be at Cambridge, England at this time, and were in England for a couple of years, and the people around us at Cambridge were really kind of tittering that Americans would do this, because, I mean, they had sexual indiscretions all the time in the British cabinet. I mean, much more kind of deviant than anything that ever occurred in the United States. Lying, I mean, it's when the prime minister is asked a question in parliament, you know, he owes it to his party to lie if he needs to keep the government in power. You know, I mean, that's, so for Europeans, you know, this was, they thought this was kind of Sunday schoolish, I guess, you know. We heard this all the time, you know, especially people in Europe perceived Nixon as a very strong leader because he did so many things in the foreign policy area. You know, solidified the Atlantic Alliance, made an opening to China, and they saw this all as great. So they just didn't understand this. And of course, then you see it, you know, coming up again, Gary Hart's, you know, indiscretions, and then pulling out of the presidential campaign. And you see it with Reagan and Meese. You know, again, the public is horrified that the leaders would lie to them or cheat on their wives or something like this. Is really, and you know, again, that can be used as evidence that there's a stronger influence of religion in the United States than again in European countries. Now, Mead traces this back to the Puritans and the influence of especially a certain kind of Protestantism with a strict moral code but weaker in doctrine on the American political system. In any case, presidents try to justify themselves morally to an extent that other leaders do not. You don't see British prime ministers, French presidents ever saying that, you know, they're following a certain kind of moral principle when they act. They're following the reason of state. They're protecting France. They're protecting Britain, the British people. That's enough. You know, nothing else has to be said. You know, you can lie, steal, cheat. They don't say it's okay to do that, but, you know, this is not a big thing for them. American leaders have to follow a certain moral code. And when charges are made, as they have been in the Clinton administration, you know, there's a kind of vigorous defense of the president's behavior in this case. You know, I mean, we see it, I mean, this has been a kind of constant with the Lewinsky thing, right? It's before our eyes. I mean, I'm sure Europeans are really, you know, laughing at us with all of this, because this is really, to them, you know, a preoccupation that shouldn't affect publics or public leaders. We have had, this has resulted, especially after Nixon, let me just refer to that for a minute. Because of Nixon's resignation, this was such a public outcry that it carried over to Gerald Ford, right, who really had done nothing, but yet was defeated in the next election by Jimmy Carter, who made a big point in his campaign about being moral. His morality was based, perhaps the most explicit, referring back to Christian principles of any president in the 20th century, except maybe Woodrow Wilson. You know, I mean, this, I think this was a reaction to the what Nixon had done. Now, Carter is now judged by political science and historians as one of the weakest presidents, you know, in the 20th century. You know, people again wanted in that kind of vague sense religion or religious-based morality to come back into the presidency.
They were outraged when he said he lusted in his heart.
Yes, yeah, yes, yeah, yes, yeah. Or that he let was a Playboy who reported that he would even, you know, let that be the carrier of his message. So that's one place. Let me just real quickly just refer to elections. Again, there was a kind of outcry about this, especially in the 1984 election, then somewhat in 1988. 92, still a little bit of it, more caused, I think, by the fact that we had clergymen thinking about running for president on each side, and Reverend Martin Luther King, Jesse Jackson on the one side, and Pat Robertson on the other. People just didn't think this was appropriate again in our society. It was the case in, especially in the period from 1928 to 1960, where religion was a factor in elections. Remember, Al Smith was defeated in 1928. Many people say because he was Catholic, there was a kind of Protestant-Catholic breakdown in the election. And then John F. Kennedy was, again, it was a factor in the election, religion, but it evidently did not affect the majority of people. Well, it didn't affect the majority of people, but even in this case, some Protestants supported, in fact, a good share of Protestants supported John F. Kennedy in that election. So that Protestant-Catholic thing is now pretty much out. Election studies, which again are kind of complicated statistical things now, have shown about an 8% variation on religion. And in the Kennedy election, the percentage was 26%. In the Al Smith election, it was 42% as a kind of religious, doing what's called analysis of variance. What has happened is there's been a split between, these days, between elites and masses, so that there is a, and this has persisted in the churches as well, where elections are seen as elite manipulation, and somebody who speaks for the people, who speak for even the people's religious value, tend to be supported by a certain group of people. So if you use a kind of sophisticated analysis of the influence of religion that gets the people's religious behavior rather than affiliation, you can find some religious influence. And those of you who work in church bodies know that there is also a kind of mass elite division there, you know, where there's a good deal of suspicion among the common people, masses, people of church hierarchies, and church hierarchies often are going off in a direction that's not endorsed wholly by the church body. It happens in both the mainline churches, where maybe the leaders are more off in a progressive direction than the people, and it happens also on the right, where some of the things Jerry Falwell says or Pat Robertson are not affirmed by many of the people in the evangelical fundamentalist camp either. So they're horrified when this comes out this way. So, well, let me, you know, I could say a lot more about this, but let me at least leave 5 minutes, I said 10 minutes, for comments and questions. This is a big subject, and we know it more from an experiential point of view, so.
Since you read about this, not doing research, what talk that we become very cynical as body politic, we've talking about things that justify some cynicism. And out of that concern, then another one, nothing that we talk about is really true unless Luther said it. In 450 some years is a long way to go back. But Luther had some specific things to say about the responsibility of the vocation of rulers.
Right.
And I wonder if, you know, in terms of our reaction as God's people today here, obviously cynicism is not a great thing and we probably shouldn't be doing it. It's probably a sin. But can you intertwine those two?
Well, yes. Well, I think, you know, we have a right to tell to people that they have to be faithful to their calling, even people who, you know, are not people of faith. I mean, this is something that that we can ask them to do. On the other hand, Luther stopped at the point where it meant overthrow of the leader. You know, a Christian could work for better leadership, but there comes a time when you accept this because, you know, God has put this ruler over you at this point.
But we can't exactly, we have to care about how we phrase this. We can't tell our leaders they have to be persons of integrity in their position because of a divine vocation.
Right.
We have to do it on the basis of mass expectation.
Mm-hmm. And we have the vehicle to do it in elections.
Yes.
And we should be very thankful for that, you know, that we can hold people to a faithful fulfillment of their vocation. That's right.
But we also have the cynicism.
Yes.
It's unbecoming of us as Christians to be cynical about people with whom we ought to be in a more constructive kind of attitude,
mm-hmm,
regarding their obedience or failure.
Yeah.
So,
yeah. The Lutheran position on what to do about these is the hardest to figure out. We just were at a conference on models of Christian higher education, and it turned out that the Lutheran approach to this, because, you know, simultaneously saint and sinner kind of thing again, you know, what kind of behavior does this finally allow? And, you know, how much criticism, how much cynicism, you know, is there? Because, I mean, we have a realistic understanding of everybody here as sinner, including the people doing the judging, you know, and but on the other hand, I mean, we belong to another kingdom, which has different standards. So it's we envied at this the Mennonites, who had a much clearer vision of what should be happening than we. In fact, we hit, I'm sorry to say, the Lutherans look the most ambiguous in the various models here. It's a hard system to work with. You're talking about Luther here, and I mean, much of Lutheran thought since then. It's I think the advantage that one has coming from the Lutheran tradition is that there is, because we do recognize a tension in all of this, maybe we're slower to rush to judgment, which might be good. I think maybe we're less inclined to label and to think things through. I don't know.
It's kind of going back to the constitutional issues. First of all, I'd say it's a very nice list of case law that you provided us here today. It's very comprehensive. One case jumps out at me in particular, the 1990 drug use case.
Yes.
One division of Oregon, V. Smith on the backside. That's where the fellow was convicted of using peyote in a religious ceremony. And we were talking, the gentleman mentioned different vehicles for reform. And I think that case prompted Congress to pass the Religious Freedom Restoration Act.
Yes.
To try to expand free exercise.
Yes.
Rights. Mm-hmm. Which then was subsequently struck down.
Right.
By the Supreme Court. Mm-hmm. This leads to my question. Oftentimes, these are very emotional cases, very important cases for people, and they spawn movements for constitutional revision with proposals for constitutional amendments and so forth. Recently, there's been a publication, the New Federalist Papers, in defense of the Constitution, which claims that the First Amendment is working, and that this wall of separation and the tension between the Establishment Clause and the Free Exercise Clause does do the job. I would just like to know your opinion. Do you think that it does work, and that sometimes you just have to take some of these things in stride, or how should we look at some of these things that we see in the media and some of our political leadership calling for amendments to the Constitution?
Mm-hmm. No, I think it has worked. I think I referred one of the other days to the fact that, I mean, this is part, I think, of that we need to affirm of our Constitution, even though sometimes, as you say, it runs against some of the things that maybe we should stand for as Christians. But the idea that there's prohibited overt religious conflict in our country, at least in this century, I mean, that's the first embodiment of the Ku Klux Klan and the American Protection Association that were fairly violent, but that's not part of our contemporary scene. And so I would say that, yes, it's been a good thing. But I don't think that should mean that we as individuals should pull back from our, either as individuals or in collectives, from trying to influence the political system, or the political system should try to keep us from saying anything. I think that the First Amendment does allow for the regular process of pressure groups operating, political parties to go ahead. And I don't, you know, I don't think we should necessarily then take this to prohibit religious activity or to condemn religious political activity. I mean, I think that this is something that needs to be affirmed. Well, yes, one more question.
What about the, you know, you're talking about the European, and how they're laughing at us in our, with our preoccupation with Lewinsky and that whole scenario. And how much of that, the press's attention on issues like that, is a smokescreen? I mean, I get cynical when I think of it. What's going on? What are the headlines that are really happening when all we're seeing is this kind of stuff?
Well, there are a lot of things going on here besides, you know, public moralism. You're right there. I mean, one of the big factors is that newspapers are part of the free enterprise system. They're competing for readership. Television stations are competing for readership, and they're going to go with something that plays in Peoria and Joplin, whatever. And people follow. There've been a lot of mass media and politics studies of this. People follow something that's a story that's got a beginning and an end, more like a soap opera. The more appealing it is, a lot of the issues you're talking about are very complicated, and newspapers know that. For instance, if they explain a change in the exchange rate, let's say over against the euro currency, you know, the dollar and the euro currency, even though this may have more to do with America's future than whether President Clinton had an affair or not, that it's just too complicated for the papers to do anything with. I mean, there you have specialized press. The Wall Street Journal will try to explain it, and, you know, New York Times financial pages. But, you know, the Seattle paper, the Portland paper, the Wenatchee paper, you know, I mean, they can't. If they're trying to compete with big city press or the national press, they can't get into this. And I think that that's operating, and then there may be something intentional. I guess I'm not that, I don't go quite that far in cynicism, you know, that this is in fact an intentional smokescreen. But it certainly works in favor of the people whose agenda is, I think, to tear down the president right now, you know, and to call attention to a personal failing and take attention away maybe from some public accomplishments. It certainly works in that direction. Whether it's, there's a lot of intentionality there, I would have to say. I think the press bears a substantial amount of blame for this, even though they're the ones who kind of condemn it, you know, this, that makes me mad. You know, they get up there, especially their kind of lead people will get up there and say, you know, we shouldn't be paying so much attention to this yet. You know, it leads on the news the next night, you know. So, because, again, they're competing for audience, and they have to.
I'm not too sure that the newspapers have too much, or media has too much integrity either. That their driving force may be, what does it take to sell?
Yes, I think that's what I was trying to say.
To scrutinize their integrity.
Well, we're kind of out of time. Thank you for your attention. Sorry, I got a little unfocused there.